The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
I'm Anna Marie Cox. Welcome to The Churn, the Expanse podcast for fans of space, slugs, and state building. Like I said, I'm Anna Marie Cox. I usually write about politics. Over there in Boston is Dan Dresner. He's a professor of international relations at the Fletcher School, and we're both huge nerds. Dan, hello.
Hello, Anna. Glad to aver to my nerdiness.
Well, I mean, if people know you at all, they already know. I'm not like saying anything that's like news to people. Speaking of obviousness, I think this episode has some obviousness to it. That's not the theme, I would say, but the title of the episode is One-Eyed Man.
Yeah. Which is something that is literally said in the episode. And yeah, the whole Illis plot is all about sight and all of that. But I have to admit something that you were saying was obvious, but I think in this season, this was my favorite episode.
Really? Interesting. Do you want to talk about the thematic, or do you want to do our thematically appropriate pull quotes? Or would you like to talk about why you think why this is your favorite episode? I think we should do thematically appropriate pull quotes.
Let's do thematically appropriate pull quotes. Hopefully I've done this right this time, because I know I
knew my quotes. No, it was not. I was just offering a helpful hint.
There you go. Okay, so I have two.
Okay.
One is from Ashford, because they're both about sight.
Uh-huh.
So one is from Ashford, where he says, "Age changes you in ways you don't expect. My focus isn't as narrow as it once was."
Huh.
And I thought that was interesting just because – really, you do have to appreciate sort of Ashford's arc in this, both in the show and from the hints that we have of his past life, even prior to the show, in that it's a contrast to what we find out about Avasarala, I would argue, in this episode, because her focus is in some ways a little too narrow. The second quote is from Amos. "When I woke up and opened my eyes, everything was still black." That line encapsulates not just this episode, but also the entire sort of theme of the Expanse, which is that you might be able to see in the Expanse, but that doesn't mean you're necessarily able to perceive. And I think in this episode, we have a lot of characters who see things, but they don't necessarily perceive them accurately.
We also have the reintroduction of Miller, or Proto Miller, one of the two, with Jim. And that's a sort of sight metaphor there, too, which is what other people can't see. And of course, he's the one-eyed man in that way as well, right? Like, he can see what other people can't see. He can see Miller. I feel like that's a really good in to the themes of this episode, a really good in to what's going on. And I missed it, which I'm chagrined, because like the last episode with all the water, all the water metaphors and water talk, like I felt really like was a way of, to use a very old nerdy term, like grokking, like the whole thing. So I didn't like the episode quite as much as you did, but I feel like if I had seen that theme of sight, I think it would have carried me through it a little better. I still liked this episode. It was real thrill packed. Like,
yeah, well, I think this is, I think, one of the few episodes where all four locations get about an equal amount of time. And you know, there's a lot going on in terms of plot and theme. And also, I don't think I'm understating it, and that I actually think the other thing I loved about this episode was that I really thought it was, and I'm going to mangle the actress's name, but Shora Agdishalu, I thought it was her best acting moment of this season.
She was amazing. And I want to talk about her a lot. Her arc in this episode, a lot of people turning away from what they used to believe or giving up on something. There are these huge shifts for a lot of our major characters where they decide to do something different. And the choices aren't always great.
Yes, that's an understatement.
They're like pivot points for a lot of people. in this episode. The quote that I chose is from Arjun, which is, there is nothing righteous about winning this way.
Oh.
And again, I do feel like a lot of the times it is true. We both do this when we pick the thematically appropriate pull quote. It applies to the entire universe of The Expanse. And I think that is true here. It's true in this episode. There's nothing righteous about winning this way applies to what Avasarala does in her campaign. But it's also true of a lot of the different things that our different factions do in The Expanse. There's nothing righteous about winning that way. Although my question for you, and we can return to this because I think it's a big question for the social scientist in the room. Is there a way of righteously winning a political campaign? Let's begin with Earth, since we're revolving around it right now. So
right, and again, it's not like there's a ton that happens, because again, it's broken up into sort of four different plots. But you know, mostly on Earth, first of all, we discover it starts with Avasarala, and we get what is, I'm not going to lie, as a fanboy, a wonderful shot of Avasarala's closet, which was not a minor thing as far as I was concerned. But the point is, Avasarala is dealing with the aftermath of Pizgazi, as Anna, you colorfully named it, but the destruction of the Pazuzula. This includes, among other things, her Marine general not only resigning, but basically chewing her out. And she has to accept the resignation. And then in what I believe I was referring to as the best acting that or the most difficult acting, I think, that Chirag Dshalulu had to do was Avasarala had to give a memorial speech for the fallen UN soldiers. And really, you know, sort of about halfway through, departs from her script and basically acknowledges to the families there that they know these people far better than she does. She talks about her own son, you know, dying and her desire to find someone to blame, and says to these families, know that I am to blame. And it's a tremendously moving moment, to the point where even her rival, Nancy Gao, describes Avasarala as a honorable woman. Right before the reporters ask Gao about the leaked footage of Illis, which is designed to scare the crap out of everyone, at which point it ends with Arjun and Avasarala having a fight, as you say, Arjun basically accusing Avasarala of A, leaking the footage designed to scare the audience, and far more significantly for them, weaponizing her son's death as a political tool. And Avasarala, you know, responds, and I'll close with this quote. You told me to connect with the voters emotionally. You wanted me to play this game. You don't get to be upset with me because I didn't play by your rules. So I do want to just say here that it was nice watching this episode, because in a previous podcast, we had talked about the fact of why wasn't Avasarala scaring the crap out of people. And as it turns out, that's what she does.
I love the acting and the writing for her in this episode. I didn't necessarily love her, but I don't think we're supposed to.
And the distinction is an appropriate one.
A lot of what you described, there's so much texture to it. We could probably spend an entire hour just talking about this particular piece of the show. The closet scene, I saw that as she's putting on her armor, right?
Exactly. Yes. That was the exact way I interpreted it.
I did think of her speech as the ode to the red shirts. That's a little bit of a joke, but also... I think it's also true that everyone's a red shirt, right, in life. Everyone's to other people. If it's not your
everyone's
family.
Everyone is someone else's red shirt.
Yes,
perhaps.
Exactly. And yet all of those people have people. And I felt like the speech she gave kind of acknowledged that gap that exists for everyone and tried to remind us that that gap really on each side is a mirror. That we really can understand each other's pain, even though we don't know the specifics of the loss. And that was it was beautiful. It was a beautiful speech. And I appreciate that beautiful speech exists in the same person as the cynicism and callousness of her political moves. Because that's people. That's what people are. They have both sides to them.
One thing I would say about, so we might fall on different sides of the fence here, because so I had two thoughts about Avasarala. The first was, my only objection to her, the shots of her during this episode, was that I seriously doubt she actually meditates.
Okay, book knowledge coming in here. She does.
Oh, okay.
In the book, it's actually she sometimes you do get Vassarella's perspective sometimes in the book, third person, but from her point of view. And I actually have a clear memory of her talking about her meditation practice at one point. I don't think she's a regular at it. Like, I think it comes and goes.
I was going to say, I mean, based on the way that the character's portrayed in the show, that was it was perfectly fine, but I was like, yeah, she doesn't strike me as someone that would do that too much. But that's just a minor nitpicky thing. The interesting thing, I think, is the argument that Arjun and Vassarella have at the end of it. I have to say, this might be where I'm not unsympathetic to Avasarala's perspective, because, you know, as she said, you know, basically Arjun tells her, how dare you, you know, weaponize our son's death. And she responds, and I think she's telling the truth here, that she was telling the truth when she gave the speech about her feelings about her son's death. And in some ways, it's one of the elements of politics that even if you are saying something that isn't factually true, sometimes it's emotionally true, or that you can, you know,
but that isn't even what's happening here. It is just true.
Right. It's just true. Exactly.
And I don't think we're on different sides. My point about her cynicism and her manipulation of other people's emotions here is that that's not something that only bad people do. It's neither good nor bad in and of itself.
No, it's politics.
It's politics. And that's what gets back to my question. When Arjun says there's nothing righteous about winning this way, I'm not sure if there's a righteous way of winning anything ever in any way.
I guess my answer is that I don't think righteousness has anything to do with it. And God forbid, by the way, if a righteous man or woman ever does win, because then they'll think that's how all politics works. And that's never how it works.
There's something I hope that you caught in what happens with the Vassarella, which is it's one of the few times in this episode where a character is told something and then winds up repeating it later.
I did not catch that. Do tell me.
She says, one of her political consultants right at the top of the show says, we need to change the narrative. And she rolls her eyes and, you know, I guess political consultants are always the same,
right?
And then to Arjun, she says,
yes,
I needed to change the narrative, or I had to change the narrative. And to me, that's where I got this idea that the theme of this episode is kind of about people pivoting. There's probably a more elegant way to talk about this, but I feel like what happens with her, what happens with Bobby, not so much. I mean, I'm not sure if it happens on Illis and it does happen actually with Ashford and Drummer, is the changing of places. Actually, with Ashford and Drummer, you could say almost literally, right?
Right.
Like the switching of places. Well, we'll see, right? Like how this is for her on the inside.
I think the other thing to realize is that in some ways it's the classic problem of politics, which is Arjun wants Vassarella to play the political game. She does play the political game. And it was clear she was actually listening. As much as she's rolling her eyes at her political consultants, as much as she's rolling her eyes at occasion at Arjun, she's not completely disregarding their advice. She's just using it in ways that clearly it never occurred to Arjun that she would do that. But as someone who studies politics, it's not entirely shocking that that's where she goes.
Yeah. And I think that this gets us to one of the truisms of The Expanse, which is that there is no such thing as all good or all bad. And and you can use sort of evil tactics to achieve what seem like good aims, you know, and you can manipulate things in a way that you are indeed manipulating. And we tend to think that is bad, but it gets us to the place that we need to be. And that's just politics.
Yeah. I would add one more harbinger, though, which is as much as Vassarella does this politically, and you can argue that it's savvy, she also says something here that struck me as not just wrong now, but clearly wrong in her time, which is that at one point, you know, she says in to Arjun, nothing else in this election should have mattered except what was going on in Illis. To put it gently, as someone who studies foreign policy for a living, one of the things I am well aware of and something I have written many times in public is that generally speaking, most people don't care about foreign policy when they vote. at least in the United States. It's one of the it's a very frustrating fact of life, because, in fact, particularly when you're voting for president, presidents have tremendous amounts of leeway when it comes to foreign policy, much more so than a lot of domestic policy or economic policy. But nonetheless, most voters don't care about it. And so one of the themes that over the entire course of this season has been her advisors telling her you've got to talk about grain shipments and things like that, and Gao talking about, you know, the inherent nature of the system. And Avasarala is never interested in any of these things. All she cares about is the foreign policy on Ilis. And in some ways, what she does with this is the most political thing possible, which is she's trying to scare the shit out of her constituents with the idea that it will hopefully cause them to vote. I will just warn listeners of this podcast, as well as those who are interested in politics more generally, that sometimes scaring people about foreign, you know, threats doesn't work the way you think it does, because people tend to care about their own circumstances more than faraway lands.
These are words of wisdom, hard earned, I know. I am going to resist comparing the situation at the UN with our current political atmosphere, but my data point as a person who observes politics for a living was those elections seem really clean. You know, like there's no organized disinformation campaigns. There's no deepfakes or bots. You know, there's no equivalent of like Russia interfering. And even the attacks that Vassarala and Gao make on each other are pretty above board. Like her big, you know, piece of mud to sling was that Gao, you know, skipped the line to get off basic, which turns out
was a legitimate piece of mud. There's this notion that somehow negative campaigning is always bad. It's not always bad. Sometimes it's a legitimate thing to point out.
And also, it wasn't like it was secret. Like, they found this out, like, from public records or whatever. Like, there was no, like, digging around in her past for an illicit, like, love affair or anything, right? It was, like, completely a totally, like, fair game point to make. And
right. And Avasarala did not accuse Gao of, like, in being in league with the OPA
right.
to send the ship in their boat. You know, scuttle the debate or anything like that.
And
so, yes.
Do you know what else there isn't in the UN elections? There's no Facebook. There's no like social media distorting everything and people having like information silos and whatnot. I am very curious if the authors and creators of this show have thought through a lot. And I'm kind of curious if they've thought through like how it is that that stuff isn't still a problem, because we could really use that advice right now.
Yes, if they've come up with some sort of tech solution or political solution, I would love to hear from them what it is. But yes, the point being that even what is considered within the confines of the expanse of dirty politics is not within, as it turns out, the real world is far dirtier in terms of its politics.
Let us journey to Medina Station. So I texted you this right after I saw the show, which is that I love Fred Johnson's dreads. I wonder if there's sort of a personality trait being exhibited here, a la Bobby Draper's hair, you know, like he's getting a little more loose, as it were, because he had a pretty tight haircut before, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say that maybe he's, you know, he's getting consistent with what we learn in this episode. He's getting a little more in the moral gray area. But given Fred Johnson's past, I don't know if that quite applies to him.
Yeah, or maybe it's more of a OPA Belter style that he's.
Oh, that could be it. Because that does seem a little more OPA-like.
The OPA people tend to, the OPA more than Belters. I would say specifically OPA activists tend to have interesting hair. If you look, like even like, well, I guess, no, it's Belters. Belters like to do stuff with their hair. I wonder if it's a zero G.
Let's put it this way. If BuzzFeed exists during this time, they would have the top 20 OPA hairstyles.
Yes. And we'll have to talk about Miller again, of course, mm-hmm. when we get to yeah. Illis.
The plot in this instance is Fred Johnson has come to town. He's visiting Medina Station. He goes into Drummer's office. Astrid says hello, and Drummer slugs him, which was just a wonderful moment. There is a lot of discussion of Drummer is clearly very angry that essentially Fred Johnson backchanneled the information they had about Marco to Earth, and therefore that's why the Earth had the intel they did. Fred Johnson explains that he did this because it allowed them to potentially maintain control of Medina Station, which, as was acknowledged in the previous episode by both Drummer and Ashford, the OPA's hold on that was somewhat tenuous. Drummer is, and Fred points out that the Medina Station will be the economic engine for the Belt, and therefore it is the most vital OPA resource. Drummer responds to this by quitting. She will no longer run Medina Station. Ashford finds her and informs her that Fred Johnson has told, essentially tasked him to hunt down and kill
Marco.
No.
He asks, Fred Johnson asks him to run Medina Station, but he
says,
what I want to do is hunt down that motherfucker Marco.
Yes, that's correct. And asks Drummer to be his XO on this mission. Drummer seems to toy with the idea, but then in the end stops by Ashford's ship to give him a good luck bottle, but explains that she's not going to go with him. And we're not sure really what she's going to do. All she says is she wants to avoid politics. And I literally shouted at the screen when she said that. You can't avoid politics, Tamina. That's not how this works. But there are really some truly lovely scenes between Ashford and Drummer in this episode.
Yeah, they're my favorite couple. I know they're not really a couple, but I love
they're
the scenes.
They're work husband and work wife.
Yes,
you know?
they're work husband and wife. I love the scenes that they're in together. And as I said before, I think that we see in this episode that they have almost completely changed political positions with each other.
No, it's an interesting contrast to season three.
Yeah, that they have journeyed from their poles on how much they should rely on the Inners, how important Belter nationalism is. And Ashford has embraced the way that she used to believe, and she's sort of embraced the way that Ashford used to believe. And even in, I think, it's almost made a little too literal, right, in giving Ashford control of Medina Station, which, by the way, I do not think he would be suited for.
I agree. Well, I think he has the self-knowledge to know that,
yes,
actually.
Yes, yes. And I think and they're still their own people, right? Like, when he says that he wants to hunt down Marco in part, you know, just sort of clean up the Belter side of the street in the treaty, in the truce, he also says he just wants to see his pretty face floating outside an airlock, and Drummer is
like, Drummer says, you haven't changed that much.
Yeah,
yes,
exactly. So he's
there's still some part of the old. Yeah.
Yeah, there's still some part of him that's like old school OPA. As for Drummer, I doubt she's going to stay out of politics. I have suspicions based on my book knowledge about what her arc is going to be. They've kind of transplanted that character. She is at this point an amalgamation of a few different characters from the books. And so I feel like there's like a whole palette of directions she could go. or they could do something entirely new, which they have done with other characters, including Avassarala's campaign arc, which does not exist in the books.
Oh, that's interesting.
In the books, Nancy Gao becomes the UN Secretary General, and Avassarala chooses to stay behind the scenes, as you and I have said for the entire season, where she belongs.
Where she belongs.
Yes.
Although, but look, that said, I have enjoyed this plot line because there is virtue in having characters where you know their strengths and weaknesses, watching them struggle in positions where they have to do something they're not necessarily good at, or we see how they adapt to harder circumstances. And so in that respect, watching Avassarala trying to adapt to the campaign has been interesting. Watching the Belters trying to adapt to governing as opposed to resisting has also been genuinely interesting. And I think Harp helps to explain why Drummer and Ashford have had some of the different reactions that they've had.
There isn't an exact mirror quote in the Medina Station plot as there was on Earth when someone else says about changing the narrative and then Avassarala talks about changing the narrative. But there is Drummer saying that she's now on the other side of a comparison she used to make, right? Which is, she used to be amused by the pictures in her office that were holdovers from when Medina Station was a Mormon generation ship. She used to laugh at them because here's this history of coveting another's homeland and killing to take it. And then she says, of course, that's where we are now. That's another interesting sort of someone moving or pivoting. Someday I'm going to come up, maybe in the course of this podcast, I'll come up with the right metaphor I'm thinking of here. But it has to do with like the ways that people like decide to do something different, like having a moral choice and being like, you know what? No, I'm not going to go the way that I thought it was going to go.
I mean, it's interesting. Again, one of the themes of this entire season, particularly for the OPA and the Belt, is that this is in part about state building. This is the OPA changing from being a resistance movement to actually trying to engage in something involving, you know, some form of governance. And, you know, one of the things about state building is that if you're going to do it, you have to have the monopoly on legitimate use of violence. And that can have some messy – trying to achieve that is a messy process, which leads to the very things that Drummer finds understandably distasteful. And also Drummer has the my favorite line of the episode, which is when Ashford is looking for her and says that he had gone to every bar in the station. She responds with, "I drink when I'm angry, not when I'm sad."
I wondered if that was a lie. It's a great line.
I don't think it is a lie. It might be a lie that she also drinks on many other I suspect it's a lie in the sense of Kamina drinks in many other situations, but I do think that she's genuinely sad.
I think she's genuinely sad. I also think she's angry.
Yeah, oh, that's fair. Okay.
And maybe she definitely was angry. She's the one that punched the guy. But maybe she's now on the other side of anger, right? Which is sad. I don't mean like it was a lie, like intentional lie, but more there's a lot going on with Drummer in that moment, I think. And it's true. I think melancholy is probably her dominant mood. Like, she doesn't like the direction things are taking. I don't think she knows for sure. She doesn't know what for sure she's going to do. All she says is stay out of politics, right? My favorite line of this arc or of this subplot comes from Ashford, however, which is Marco is a nihilist in the guise of a patriot.
I had that written down.
Which, again, yeah. Going to avoid making too many comparisons to our current domestic political situation, but that's a really good description of people who govern on force of personality, let's say.
Yes. No. In terms of, you know, charismatic Weberian leadership, I would say Ashford could have gotten a master's in political science. That's all I'm saying.
Anything else you want to say about Minia Station before we journey through the rings? Or should we go to Mars? Let's go to Mars.
Let's go to Mars before we go to Illis.
Yeah.
I think the only other interesting thing was just the notion of the idea that the belt, that the Medina Station is the economic lifeblood of the belt. And I do wonder going forward what the implications of that will be. But, you know, that's mostly a harbinger for future episodes.
Would you like to run down our subplot of Mars, the doings of Mars?
Yes. So on Mars, basically what happens is the criming gang meets and there is a new heist. And this heist is
not a heist.
It's almost too good to be true in that literally all they have to be is sort of take the cargo, which they have not stolen, and move it from point A to point B. They will apparently earn 10 times, I think, what they have earned in prior, criming. And so this is one of these things where, Isai and Manic Pixie Crime Girl are very excited about this. Bobby is sufficiently wary about it. At the same time, Bobby is also dealing with personal issues. As her boyfriend Thomas has decided to interview for a job, I believe it's ice mining in Europa. What happens is that Bobby also runs into her nephew David and discovers that David is joined the terraforming, got into the terraforming program, so that's great news. Two other significant things happen. First, we get a glimpse into Isai's home life, the crime boss's home life, which, as it turns out, is extremely normal. He's married. He has two kids. And we have a very interesting conversation between Bobby and Isai about in which Isai explains why he is doing what he is doing, why he wants to take this job, which Bobby suspects, which is he no longer has faith in Mars. And he says something, as you've pointed out, one of the things Bobby keeps being described as a good Martian. This is where Isai says, "I was a good Martian my entire life, but no longer," because his basic argument is, And I think it's the sort of longest exposition in terms of this point that we've been seeing throughout the season, is that he is extremely skeptical that Mars will continue to terraform and that Martian culture will stay as it is. Whereas Bobby says that Mars is changing, it's not dead, and sort of resists that. And then finally, Bobby breaks up with Thomas, and I want to talk about that, but I want to get your take on that first.
Yeah, there's a lot of exposition, unusual amount of exposition, I think, in the Mars subplot in this episode, but it's all good. It's all interesting. I appreciated very much the reminder, once again, that not everyone is all good or all bad, that Isai has very much a not just like home life, right? It's like an adorable home life, an adorable imperfect home life. Like his kids are acting kind of bratty when she comes in, which I liked, you know, like it was like you captured him like in real life.
Well, to be honest, the other thing I kept thinking was is that only in Mars Isai is your classic honorable criminal, in that only in Mars would the leader of a crime gang give one of the henchmen the actual address in which he lived.
She does seem like she found it, by the way. That, remember, she's kind of walking down the corridor and she's like, is this it? Or maybe, I don't know, maybe he gave it to her. You're right.
No. I thought she had, like, I basically thought that she knew where the address was. And I think she was surprised by the home life, but I don't think she was surprised that that's where, she was surprised when his wife answered the door.
Right.
And also I did love, you know, that Isai described Bobby as a consultant
again,
to his wife.
Yes.
So that continues the consultant line. Yes, exactly.
Well, I want to get to the terraforming and generations here, which is that's a mini theme, or it's been a big theme throughout our discussions of Mars. It's sort of a mini theme in this episode, which is the degree to which terraforming is a generational project and the degree to which other things could be generational projects. Because Isai talks about terraforming as a generational project that is now dead, right? Just gone. And Bobby says Mars is changing. He says Mars, the dream of Mars is dead. She says Mars is changing. It's not dead. And then he says something, just to continue a life metaphor here. He says Mars promised everyone a garden, or Mars promised a garden for everyone. Well, he feels like obviously that's not going to happen. So he wants to create choices, theme of choice, for his children, a new generational project. He's not even thinking of himself. He is continuing to be a good Martian in the sense that he's not thinking of himself. He is thinking of future generations.
No, and the other thing that becomes clear in this, you know, because again, think about how we're first introduced to Isai. We sort of see him as, oh, he's a corrupt cop. So, you know, most viewers are not going to have that great of a view of him. What becomes very clear in this episode is that he's not doing the criming he's doing the criming for the money, but it was clear that he was not doing it. This is not something he's been doing for a long time. This is a legitimately disillusioned Martian.
Disillusionment gets us to my little snarky comment about David being on the terraforming project, which is so that whole interaction is very movingly awkward. And it confirms a suspicion of mine, which is that Bobby has been living at that fancy hotel, that she's no longer living at home.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah.
Because she hasn't seen David in a long time. I think when David tells her that he's on the terraforming team, it makes her sad because she's just had this conversation with Isai and she's starting to suspect the same thing. In fact, this is the other place where someone does a mirror dialogue, which is she's the one who defends the dream of Mars to Isai. But then in her conversation with Thomas, which maybe we can start talking about that now, she's the one who says the dream of Mars is dead.
So I had a slight, so this is interesting. I had a slightly different take on this, which is I agree with you. What you're saying isn't necessarily wrong, but the Bobby's conversation with David, the conversation I kept coming back to, wasn't the one in this episode, but I think it was the one in episode 3 when she's drunk and castigates David for not understanding the sacrifices that she's made for the future generations. Now we're in a situation where Bobby is talking to David and David is the good Martian. And Bobby is the one who, while admittedly defending Mars to Isai, has nonetheless gone fairly down the criming path, And so I think the argument that she winds up having with, you know, with Thomas after that is not based on, is based in some ways on self-loathing. That I assumed that my inference was that based on her interactions with David, she realizes that the arcs of their two lives have changed considerably.
Here's a place where you picked out a theme that I was talking about. I didn't even see this, here's the mirroring theme.
That's the mirroring, yes.
That's what it is.
There you
That's
go.
What
That's
it is.
Point to Anna.
And even there's a discussion. Well, I guess it was in the last episode. There's a discussion of the mirrors on Ganymede. So I can't get points for that. But yes, it's the mirroring theme or the mirroring metaphor in this.
Or doppelganger.
Yes. Well, no, I think mirroring. Now they've now traded places. Yeah. They've now their journeys have mirrored each other.
I have to tell you, so two things about Bobby's fight with her beau, Thomas, which is, first of all, that waffle takeout carton looked awesome.
Oh, my God. I've written down here, the takeout tech seems to have improved a lot in the next two centuries.
Yes, my God, that was amazing. You know, again, this isn't like a huge deal. Like, but still, whoever did the set design for that little waffle takeout thing, you know, props to the expanse, because it's like, how are you going to do takeout waffles? Oh, that's how you do takeout waffles.
It's like a little tower of like cardboard, and he unfolds it. It's like an origami. It's like origami. It's like a origami takeout box.
I that made me happy, and I want some restaurant in 21st century Earth to adopt that.
Okay.
The other thing is that if you think about it, Bobby's position in this argument didn't make any sense to me. Thomas is actually saying, come with me. Let's try to do a different life because Mars is changing. We could both, you know, potentially survive out there. And Bobby responds by saying, are you trying to say you want to save me or something? And I think Thomas isn't trying to say that at all. Thomas doesn't feel that way. He feels like they could both thrive somewhere else, that Mars is changing in a way that doesn't necessarily help them. And I'm not entirely sure I understand why Bobby is so angry.
I think she's having a crisis of conscience that has been simmering this entire season, right? Like, she does not know what to do with herself.
Right. And I do think the interaction with David helps to trigger that because, it inspires even more doubts about is she on the right path and so forth. That's fair.
So she has her military first taken away from her, and then she devotes herself to her job decommissioning military equipment. And then she, as you and I have discussed in previous episodes, she kind of makes the Martian crime family her unit. After that.
Right.
And then that becomes clear that that's not necessarily a stable thing and also not exactly what she thought it was. Not betrayed by it exactly, but just.
Although I would say Isai does her right here.
He totally does. But I just think that she.
He actually says, you don't owe me anything anymore. I mean, I was actually genuinely moved by Isai saying that.
Oh, you know, I agree. But it's yeah. I think it's not going to be permanent, right?
Oh, yes, that's right.
It's not going to stay together. She needs a unit to be a part of. That is who Bobby is. Bobby functions best when she has a thing to believe in, a purpose to pursue. In fact, going back, I think, first or second episode, our conversation with Alex, when Alex says, how do you stay so brave? And she says, you just have to believe that what you're doing is worth fighting for.
Why she doesn't react as well to Tom.
Yeah, she needs a thing to fight for. And she's been looking for something throughout this episode. And she just, she's been frustrated. I think poor Thomas is just getting the raw... Bobby.
Thomas is the object of her anger. I don't think he's the cause of it. I guess that would be the way to put it, because you're right. I think from Thomas's perspective, you know, building a life on Europa might be pretty nice, you know, with Bobby. And I think you're right. The problem is Bobby needs a higher social purpose, and just having, you know, a life for herself on Europa isn't it.
Yeah. I want to note another thing, another set deck thing, which is what I thought was art out the window is actually the surface of Mars. I thought that those were like an image of the surface of Mars, but no, it's an actual picture, which means that's a really fancy hotel, by the way, in order to have a view of the surface.
Having actual windows, yeah. There was one other thing I wanted to say about this, which was, this is where I actually think Isai is wrong, but it was this claim that part of the reason he thinks terraforming won't continue is that the development of the ring worlds, the opening of the ring worlds, would lead to a brain drain on Mars. That's possible, but I'm pretty dubious of that. I mean, look at it this way. Within the politics of the expanse, maybe that would happen. But I think in whether that parallels to the real world, I am somewhat dubious of, which is brain drains like that usually tend to only happen to places that are thriving economies. And while the ring worlds will be interesting frontier places, I'm not sure you're necessarily going to see that kind of exodus of skilled human capital.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Before we leave Mars, the quote I would like to end on, and I think it encapsulates what I believe the situation to be for Bobby. She says to Thomas, "Everything we've ever fought for has been for nothing." And he says, "You really believe that?" And she doesn't answer.
Ooh.
Which I think means that she really is in the middle of emotional, ideological, philosophical turmoil here. I don't know if she believes that or not. I don't think she does. I think she's trying that out. You know, she's trying out the idea of, am I really cynical about this? You know, do I believe it's all for nothing?
I think she's trying out. No, I think you're right. I think she's she is in a state of uncertainty. She's not sure. She needs a narrative for what's happening and a belief system to consider about with respect to Mars. And I think you're right. She's trying them on like different coats. And it's not clear which one will stick.
There is not a ton of plot on Illis. There's interesting things that happen, interesting dialogue exchanges. But to the extent
there's tension as well,
things happen. Dan, would you like to please inform us?
Sure. So not much happens in orbit. They're basically in the Barb and the Rossi are knitting the cable that will presumably be used to take the Barb to a higher orbit. Down on Illis, everyone is blind. Except for Holden, and Holden is kind of exhausted by this because essentially he has to guide both the Belters and the RCE folks to places like the latrine. People keep wandering off and having slugs fallen on them, so they die. Amos is freaking the fuck out, it would be safe to say, and that he has this torch, and even though his eyes aren't really working well, he's basically trying to fry as many slugs as he can. At one point, he wanders off without any covering, which leaves him potentially open to the slugs. Holden manages to bring him back in. But clearly, Amos is incredibly disconcerted by going blind. One of the nice, I thought, costume touches is that because they're all worried about slugs falling on them, essentially this almost felt like a monastery episode because everyone's wearing hoods. What was interesting is that even Murtry, who is blind again during this episode, says Captain Holden rather than Holden. And it's sort of a signal that even he recognizes he's in a relatively powerless situation. But the one thing the one virtue that we discover that happens from a conversation between Holden and Okoye, Okoye tests Holden's eye fluid and through conversation discovers that the reason that Holden can see is not because of proto-Miller or anything like that, but rather because he is on cancer meds from something that, from the season one exposure on Eros. And so once they realize that, they can replicate the drugs. Everyone begins to get their eyesight back. There is a lovely scene on Eos at the very end of sort of things getting better. Like the Expanse doesn't use uplifting music a lot, but there was definitely uplifting music in that scene. Nonetheless, the episode ends on Illis with two rather disconcerting facts. The first is that Murtry starts talking to the Edward Israel about using the second light shuttle as a bomb. And second, Holden finally sees proto-Miller, or does he see proto-Miller? Proto-Miller is having some issues. It ends literally with proto-Miller screaming.
Yes, he's glitchy. There's a glitch. There's a glitch in the Matrix. So I want to talk about Amos a lot, but first I will just toss off a couple of different observations. One is a small little science-y tech set deck thing that I noticed that's slightly problematic, which is you would think that these fancy computers that they have a read text aloud function.
Oh, yes. That, I have to say that was one of the more amusing elements of the episode, was that Okoye makes Holden have to read all of the scientific, you know, chemicals and concentrates and so on and so forth.
Does Siri not exist? Like, hey, Siri, read me that, you know. Oh my God, I just set off Siri.
Thank you, Dr. Okoye. Holden's eye fluid contains. That would have been hysterical.
And the other thing is I did appreciate that it was almost immediately in the episode that they have Murtry say the one-eyed man cliche. So it's like, yeah, we know. and then also the immediate response from Holden is that line about taking people to the latrine, which I think kind of is another, yeah, we know that's we're using a cliche here, but this is real life, right? Like there is like life and death happening here.
No, and this is one of the virtues of the Expanse, is there is a grubbiness to even space that they deal with that you admire.
But there's a lot to say about Amos, right? As you said, he uses the flamethrower to kill the slugs even beyond the point where he needs to. What he says to Jim is, "I'm just sending a message to the rest of them in case they keep coming," which to me sounded like something that a strategy he's used before, let's say. And when he talks about his time in Baltimore in the dark basement, I actually thought of that line, "I'm sending a message to the rest of them in case they keep coming." I bet that there's something like that happened in that basement. His capacity for self-protection comes from a specific place.
This is one of those episodes where you actually sort of have to stand back and marvel, given Amos's background, at how actually relatively normal he can be at times. we've talked about this, that he's a killer. He has some interesting views in terms of morality, but nonetheless, he has sufficient powers of self-knowledge so that he has actually carved out a relatively good life for himself. And I think we got a window in this episode into some of the horrors in his past.
Another exchange that I felt very evocative, was Chandra says to him, "It's okay if you're scared." And he says, "I don't know what I am."
Yeah.
And that reminded me of an exchange I had with Wes Chatham, the actor who plays Amos, in an interview earlier in this podcast. Not this podcast, an earlier episode of this podcast, where he talked about how part of Amos's journey is figuring out what emotions are, basically. He's not autistic. He's not on the spectrum. He's not a sociopath. But he's like just tamped down everything so tightly that he only allows himself to experience a few different emotions. Like that's how he protects himself. And that is, according to Wes, like he's read up on post-traumatic stress syndrome. That's one of the ways that survivors deal with traumatic memories, is just to kind of like shut down a lot of the scarier emotions. And one of those emotions is fear. And I believe we've had exchanges with other characters in Amos before where they've talked about him being brave or him experiencing fear. And he says he doesn't know what that means. And that for him, it's just a choice of like protect or not protect, basically, like self-protection or protection of his team, his family, his people. So I believe him very much when he says he doesn't know what he feels, because I think that fear is something that he's trained himself not to feel it. So if he's feeling it now, he may not know what it is.
And to go back to your larger, you know, theme of sort of mirrors within this episode of characters doing things we wouldn't have otherwise expected of them. In some ways, Amos is the one on Illus who does this, because Holden is Holden during this episode.
Right.
He literally says at one point, "It's on me," throughout. And this episode is in some ways the most literal version of he has to save everyone because he's the only one who can see. It's Amos who is in a very different state than we normally see him, just completely, you know, dealing with the emotions that he has tamped down for so long, and therefore in many ways vulnerable in a way that we've never seen him before on the show.
There's a exchange between Amos and Jim that I have to believe was deliberate, although it made me raise an eyebrow, which is after Jim goes out to save Amos, who again had, I think, a psychotic episode basically, or sleepwalking, something, you know, when he goes off not wearing very many clothes to where the slugs are. You know, Jim brings him back and he sits Amos down. Amos is blind, of course, and he says, "Amos, look at me." He says it twice. I could consider like, oh, that's just a weird, maybe ad-libbed it. Twice, it's in the script. It's there for a reason. Because he obviously can't actually look at Jim.
Right.
So I feel like what Jim is actually saying is, to get to the theme that you picked up about sight, about seeing, right? He's saying, see me. Like, understand.
Or perceive what I'm trying to
say. Yes. Yeah. And understand that I am here for you, right? That you can depend on me. And that you don't have to do it all by yourself.
Right. And that's also a piece with your theme, that our themes have merged, because that's the counterpoint of what we normally see in the relationship between Holden and Amos, where Amos is the one who is always the reliable surrogate.
I feel like there's only maybe a couple more things to say about Illis. One, Chandra says to Amos in this very, before things start to get better, when it's bleakest, she says to him, "People like us deserve a say in how we go out." Mm-hmm. Which to me says something about Chandra and not Amos. As I've been saying, I think that maybe she's not such a, as much as we like her for liking Amos, have some doubts about her. Because I think Amos would argue, although he's not in position to really make any arguments at this point when she talks to him, he's so traumatized, that everyone deserves a choice about how they go out. In fact, that's in episode one. Yeah. It's clear that...
Oh, right. With his sister?
No, it's Clarissa Mao, who had been a prisoner on their ship, but also was a good mechanic. And he gave her a chance to space herself before going back to her life sentence on Earth. I don't think Amos sees, I mean, yes, he sees himself as a killer and stuff, but I think the idea of choice is pretty central to the way that he thinks of people in general, right? Like, everyone deserves a choice. That's a principle for him. And Chandra saying people like us deserve a choice in how we go out seems a little perverse to me.
It, as they say, the data points are starting to add up about Chandra, and that as much as we might like her because she likes Amos, she clearly does not. Their worldviews are not quite as compatible as she would like to think.
Yeah, maybe not necessarily a good long-term relationship material.
Right.
The only other thing I feel like we need to touch on before we say goodbye to Illis and to our audience is that very trippy scene of Miller and Proto Miller glitching back and forth. And we see Miller in his stereotypical noir detective outfit, and we see Miller with the creative Belter haircut. That's the two images of him that come up. And I actually think, I'm not certain, I think that the image of him that's not in costume is wearing like a Belter jumpsuit. Like, it's a very Belter identified kind of outfit. Do you know what I mean?
You paid closer attention than I did to that. I confess. I just remember, I thought it was just a black shirt and black pants. I didn't think it was a jumpsuit.
I think I think it was like maybe the kind of thing he was wearing when he was either crewing with the Rossi or he was like getting ready to work with the OPA to take on Protogen. Like, I think the outfit's important, basically. That's what I'm saying.
We can talk about this in episode 9, because in some ways it happens a lot more there than it does here.
Right. Well, presumably people realize that that's a, we're not seeing the last of this particular glitchy character. So I don't feel like that. I don't think I'm saying
this
too
is
much.
Where I would think. Yes. Well, the other thing I was going to bring up is that this is where being on Amazon Prime is a little useful, because when you pause it watching there, it'll show the characters and the actors' names, sometimes about who's in the scene. And when you do it for this sequence, what you get is Thomas Jane as the investigator and Thomas Jane as Josephus Miller.
Oh, and that's interesting, because when you watch it with subtitles, which is, I believe, again, something I texted you about.
Oh, and yes, and I definitely do that.
The subtitles identify Miller and real Miller.
Yes. Oh, that's interesting.
So we're giving absolutely nothing away. If you paid close enough attention to this episode, stuff is going to happen in the next episode about Miller and Proto Miller and how they're not necessarily the same thing. I feel like this was a bonus sized episode. So we've gone on a little bit of a bonus sized episode of this podcast. I appreciate as usual, you coming on, Dan. If people are interested in following you in other areas of your work, where might they find your writing, my good friend?
I'm happy to answer that question. They can find my writing in the Washington Post. I write a column for them called Spoiler Alerts. They can follow me on Twitter.
Which is not about science fiction. We should be very clear that your column that is called Spoiler Alerts is not about science fiction.
It's not about science fiction. It's mostly about politics, though I occasionally write a science fiction column. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Drezner, D-R-E-Z-N-E-R. And I also have a book coming out in the spring called The Toddler in Chief, What Donald Trump Teaches Us About the Modern Presidency.
And if anyone who's listening is going to be at South by Southwest, they can come see me interview you about that book at South by Southwest in March.
Which I am very excited about, yes.
This is going to be, we're going to have a blast. And we have to work in some Expanse talk at some point during that conversation. If people want to follow me on Twitter, they can do that. Also, I have another podcast called With Friends Like These. There are at least two more episodes for us to discuss of The Expanse. So let us end this humongous, jumbo-sized recap. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Anna, thanks for having me.
Until next time.